doing some insight meditation practice together. And then afterwards, a short break. And then I'm going to start, you do kind of an introductory overview talk tonight on what I think is probably going to wind up being a multi-part series of the Buddha's teachings on karma. And the reason that I am, it's one of those things that, you know, over the course of 40 some odd years of studying and practicing Buddha Dharma, it's one of those things that I have kind of an approach avoidance relationship with. The concept is relatively foreign to Western philosophy and Western epistemology, you know, the study of how things are, how we think things might be. And also, it's easily confused with teachings out of the Hindu tradition. And so I would kind of come up and have a taste and then say, yeah, that doesn't make any sense, and run away. And then I'd come back later and have another read. And after I had gone through seminary and we were having these in-service training retreats, those of us who were leading Dharma groups around the country, and one of them was one of the foremost English language translators of the Pali Canon, Bhikkhu Bodhi. And one of the things that we had been advised or admonished to do when we were in training is, well, you know, it's best to teach that of which you have personal experience. So you're not just rattling off some doctrine you read someplace, but something that you can relate to individually and bring your own life experience to bear on. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a really wonderful, fascinating guy, but he's pretty conservative in his views. And one of the, he talks about the difference between what he calls adaptive Buddhism and canonical Buddhism. And we had all been trained at Spirit Rock, where, you know, there's a lot of Rumi poetry and other things that are getting folded into people's Dharma talks. He said, you just need to be clear about whether you're teaching Buddhism or not. And so somebody said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, and this kind of got everyone's attention. He said, if you're not teaching karma and rebirth, you're not teaching Buddhism. And that really took a lot of people aback, because most of the folks in our cohort said, well, you know, I don't really have any personal experience of rebirth, so I don't really feel that that's the topic that I should bring up. I don't have a friggin' clue about karma. He said, you can just be clear when you're teaching these things that it is or is something of which you have some personal experience. And if, you know, for instance, in the case of rebirth, if you don't, then you can just say, well, this is what the Buddha taught, you know, and it might be worthwhile keeping an open mind. With regard to teachings on karma, the Buddha once said that, you know, if you spend all your time trying to fathom the mysteries and the intricacies of the laws of karma, you will drive yourself mad. And he just said that just get enough of a feel or a taste or an understanding of it as you can in order for it to help inform how you live your life. And so I guess that was sort of good enough for me, but from time to time, it would just come up and I would be reading some text or other and then conclude, okay, it's time for me to go back and have a closer look, study a little more deeply, reflect a little bit more on what these teachings are relative to my own experience, and then see if a new kind of understanding or insight can arise from that reexamination. Kind of like a double helix, you know, and so I've cycled around a few times now with regard to those teachings, and I'm finding myself in one of those periods where I'm cycling back in again and taking up those teachings and seeking to develop a somewhat deeper understanding of them, and as it goes, a deeper appreciation. And one of the reasons that I'm doing that now is because, for me, given the sort of confluence of really dramatic dukkha-laden challenges that we're finding ourselves encountering right now as a culture and as a society, as a body politic, I've been coming back again and again and again to, okay, what do the teachings of the Buddha have to say about the circumstances that we find ourselves in right now? In terms not just of how we relate to them individually, but how we are relating to them as a society. What are some of the narratives and the voices that are out there, the ones that seem to be inclined toward the beneficial and the wholesome and those which don't seem to be? How can we bring these teachings to bear? And in these teachings, there are these ideas or these ways of thinking about it. The Buddha started off with this teaching, of course, in terms of how to develop a better understanding and better insight into personal karma. But there is also, at the same time, a notion of shared karma, that which we share as a society as a result of actions that were taken in the past by the society of which we were a part. And it's karma that we all experience and we all experience together. And so the investigation for me right now is, okay, what are some of the Buddha's teachings on how to relate to one's personal karma that might have some application to understanding and working with our shared karma as a culture, as a society, and as a body politic? And so that's where my own investigation, my own inquiry is taking me right now. And so that's something that I want to talk about this evening and to discuss together. So this evening I'm going to present, I think, a bit of a, sort of an overview of sort of the topic, and then focus mostly a little bit on working with the teachings on karma on the personal level, and then over the course of, you know, the remaining Sundays in November and December, then take it a little bit deeper and apply it more directly to some of the challenges that we face socially, and how can we bring teachings on karma to bear in non-dual speech and action with regard to some of the challenges facing us as a society. So, okay, so there's that. And so that's how I'm going to be looking forward to sharing my own thinking and hopefully us being able to have some discussion around that for this month and next. But of course, everything we do is informed by what we find when we allow the mind to have a closer and closer look at what's going on in the moment. And so that, of course, is what we're going to do now, do some insight meditation practice together. So, whether you're sitting on a chair, on the couch, you know, kicking back in your chaise lounge, or watching me with one eye and, you know, whatever's on TV on the other, I really hope not. I don't advise it. Please just settle in. Find your sitting posture. And allow your relationship with gravity, you know, the relationship between your center of gravity and that of the Earth 4,000 miles directly below you, to take over a little bit. Just relax a little bit into your relationship with the Earth. Yeah. Allow the body to become calm and centered, relaxed and at ease. Arms relaxed at your sides. Hands maybe folded in your lap or resting on your legs. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on your breathing. Whether you notice it mostly as the air flowing in and out of the nostrils, or maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day. If you find it helpful for relaxing, you can draw in maybe a nice, long, slow, deep breath. Hold it for a second and then let it out. Let it out completely. Slowly, it flows all around you. And then doing the same again. Nice, deep, relaxing breath all the way down into the belly. And then letting it flow forth again, like the waves of the ocean washing over a low tide pool. Flowing in and flowing out. And then as we become more relaxed, simply noting the breathing as it is, without trying to breathe in any special way. Just inquiring into what it feels like for the body to breathe itself. Noting whether you're breathing a long breath or a short breath, a deep breath or a shallow breath, a rapid breath or a slow breath. Simply allowing the breathing to find its own natural pace and depth and rhythm. And then as the mind becomes a little clearer and calm from attending to the breathing, allowing the field of awareness to expand, to take on not only the breathing, but also sounds and bodily sensations and thoughts and emotions. Allowing whatever becomes the mind's predominant object of attention to likewise become the object of meditation. Watching each of these phenomena in their turn as they arise and change and pass away. As if you're outside, looking at a vast, clear, blue sky. White, fluffy clouds appear, just like thoughts and emotions and bodily sensations. They move across the sky, and they fade away. Sky remains open and spacious and clear. The mind that contains all things and yet is not made up of them. Whatever crosses the mind, whether it's awareness of the breathing, or a bodily sensation, or a thought, or an emotion, and whether you judge it to be pleasant, or unpleasant, or neutral, to simply make the soft mental note, this too, if the mind becomes distracted or lost in thought or in a powerful emotion, as soon as you know this has happened and you come back to the present moment, simply know this too. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I shall become the heir. Okay. So we have just a few moments for a little stretch break now. And then I'll ring your bell and we can get back together again. Have a talk and some discussion. This is the time we set aside for any Sangha-related announcements or upcoming Dharma-related activities anyone knows about. So does anyone have anything they'd like to share right now?
I do, if no one else.
Yes, please.
Okay. So I posted on chat a couple of retreats that David Chernikoff is hosting next month. So they're at home retreats, and one is great Grief, Joy, and Awakening, December 3rd through the 6th. And then Living Fully, Loving Well, on December 28th through 31st.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. Yeah, I saw those.
And then I also will post the information for giving Donna. We really appreciated everybody that had. I know it's a little more difficult to give Donna in this time of Zoom. And the Insight Meditation Community of Denver is the one that gives Donna to the Sunday night teachers. So we're grateful for your generosity.
Yeah, good. Thanks. Appreciate that. Okay. Anything else? Well, I may have mentioned this before here in the Sangha, but one of the things that I'm finding to be really enriching for my own practice these days, you know, we have this 8 a.m. set every weekday or every morning that various of us teachers in the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado Collective take turns hosting. But friend, teacher, mentor Gil Fromsdale with the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, also every morning at 8 a.m. our time, does a half hour guided sit, followed by about a 15 or 20 minute Dharma talk, a little Dharmette. And he is just in the midst now of doing a series on the Eightfold Path. And so if you just set your browser for Gil Fromsdale, I can write the stuff down at the end of course, it's my Insight Meditation Center. It's broadcast on YouTube and also the direct feed from their website. And he's a wonderful teacher, and I'm learning stuff I didn't know before from sitting with him, so you might find that to be a useful thing to do sometimes. Okay, so again, this is going to be kind of an overview talk this evening, touching on actually quite a few related topics, but not going into a lot of depth on any one of them tonight, but circling back around over the next three Sundays together, we'll sort of have that opportunity. So, how many of you are now or have been in your practice really on fire to learn more about karma? Okay, good. It's not necessarily, you know, a real hot topic in Western Dharma circles. And there are a few reasons for that. One of them is because here in the West, there has been a real tendency to confuse what the Buddha had to say about karma with Hindu teachings on it. And because karma was a doctrine or a law or a way of looking at things that existed before the Buddha came along. The teachings of Brahmanism, which later became known as Hinduism, that tradition posits the existence of a permanent and abiding self that undergoes multiple sequential reincarnations, which is to say that the same soul, the same essential being, gets reborn over and over and over again in various forms, different animal forms and then human forms. And the form that a birth takes, that a person takes in any given lifetime, is a product of the karma that was accumulated in the previous lifetime. And so also in in Indian society at the time of the Buddha, there was a caste system, you know, four major categories plus the untouchables or Dalits, and then hundreds of little kind of subcategories within each of the four major ones. With the Brahmins at the top, the priestly class, and the next one down was the Kshatriyas, and those were the public administrators, the monarchs, the rulers, the, you know, the folks that ran the government. And the Buddha was a Kshatriya. He was born into that sort of ruling caste. And then there were merchant castes and all the, you know, artisan castes. And the way that the Brahmins taught karma and the caste system is that whatever station in life you were born to, if you played by the rules and fulfilled all your obligations to everyone that you had responsibilities to, and of course gave dana to the Brahmins, paid your dues to the temples, that you would stand a pretty good chance of getting reborn the next time around in a higher caste, until eventually maybe you'd hit the big time and become a Brahmin. And then if you kept at it, then you would be born a male Brahmin, because only male Brahmins could actually ascend to become one with Brahma. So at any rate, that was the system. And the Buddha didn't have much truck with it. He felt it was kind of self-serving insofar as the Brahmin priests were concerned. So he didn't cotton with that much. But the principal point of departure between the Hindu notions of karma and its relationship to the permanent and abiding self and soul that's reborn into either higher or lower realms, depending on how one behaved in this lifetime, was the principal point of departure between Hindu concepts of reincarnation, which is to say the same soul or the same being being reincarnated, taking another body later on, is the Buddha's teaching on, and this was Brahman and Atman, the union of Brahman, the Godhead, and Atman, the soul or the essence. And the Buddha's teaching was Anatman, Anatta, which is to say non-self. And so this is like the, doctrinally, this is one of the major watershed distinctions between Hinduism, Brahmanism, and Buddhism. Because he said, rather than there being a permanent and abiding self that goes through multiple reincarnations, each incarnation dependent upon how one behaved in the previous incarnation, what he taught was that, in fact, there is no permanent and abiding self, that, in fact, the mind gives birth to self on a moment-to-moment basis. And that the form or structure or function of your consciousness in any given moment is going to be, to some extent, a product of your state of mind in the previous moment. So that we are in the process of rebirthing ourselves on a continuous basis. Okay. And another of the kind of misconceptions about karma, you know, in the West, is that somehow it's destiny or fate or that's foreordained or immutable, and confusing, you know, actions with outcomes or consequences, which is also not at all where the Buddha was coming from. The word karma in Sanskrit, or kama in Pali, literally means action. It means acting in the world, taking an action in the world, saying something or doing something, manifesting one state of being in the world through action in the world. Not all actions generate karma. in order for karma to be generated, whether wholesome or unwholesome, the action or the speech needs to be what's called volitional, which is to say that there is underlying intention. Okay. Interestingly, in this way of thinking about things, the intentions can be subconscious. It can be like the tip of an iceberg, that you think you're doing something for one reason when in fact you're doing it for another. So you may tell yourself that this is my intention, but there may be very mixed motives at work that you may not even be aware of. Okay. So there's that. How does this all relate to the Buddhist core teachings on how one attains freedom? And so we're going to kind of relate this all a little bit to the Eightfold Path. How one, having discovered that suffering, discontent, dissatisfaction exists in the world, this cause, craving, wanting things to be different than they are, its cessation, how the suffering might be brought to an end, and then the path, how one goes about doing that. So, and of course we know that the Buddha's principal icon for the expression of this teaching was this eight-spoked wheel, the Dharma Chakra, or Dharma wheel. No. In the earliest depictions with the empty hub at the center and eight spokes that meet in the empty center and that touch the outer world. Okay. And that each spoke needs to be of roughly the same strength as the others in order for the structure to maintain itself. So they're all important and they all have a role to play. So we have the meditative factors of samadhi. Sama means right. It's the way the 19th century British translators translate sama. Can more accurately be translated as beneficial or wholesome or that which conduces to the cessation of suffering. Okay. So we have these three meditative factors of a tranquil, calm, focused, concentrated mind. So, and the meditative factor of right effort, skillful effort. Okay. And the meditative factor of mindfulness, of being aware with great precision of exactly what is going on in the mind at any given moment in time. The meditative factors get strengthened, they get enriched, they prepare the soil, they prepare the consciousness for the ability to begin to have insights. Okay. And these are where the two wisdom factors come into play. The first, the two wisdom factors, is sometimes called right understanding or right view. Okay. And by that is meant being able to apprehend, to see the Buddha's teachings on not self and the Buddha's teachings on dependent origination. The Buddha's teachings on insight into one's own karma, which is to say, all of the causes and conditions in your life that gave rise to who you are at this moment in time. And so once we begin to do this practice and it really becomes a part of how the mind works, then from time to time, we begin to have these insights when we see, you know, repetitive thoughts or emotions or whatnot come up. And we just watch the mind do that. So what's that about? You know, and you start to kind of walk it back. What is that thought or emotion or whatnot that's happening in the moment? What does it seem to be related to? Is there some kind of threat or opportunity that I experienced in the past that's associated with that causes that thought or that emotion to arise and to arise repeatedly. So what's going on in the mind in the moment is a product of everything that's gone before. And again, the departure point between Buddhism and, you know, other theistic traditions, whether it's Hinduism or the Western traditions, is that in that moment of recognition of the relationship between either something that happened to me in the past or something I did in the past and my state of mind in the moment, okay, that combined with the Buddha's teachings on not-self is insight into, and this is where the real distinction between the theistic traditions or between, you know, Hinduism and Buddhism come into play. If there is this permanent self, then looking back and seeing really unskillful things you've ever said in the past that caused harm to yourself or others can be a cause for shame, self-condemnation in the present moment. If you're looking back over everything that's happened to you in your life and everything that's been done to you and everything that you've done, and you can see that all those things coming together to create who you are in this moment is just that. It's how all of these things are coming together to create who I am in the moment. Then when you look back on things that you might be feel really badly about or know that you did that were really unskillful, that were really harmful to yourself or others, then instead of looking back with shame from the standpoint of self, you're looking back with insight and compassion because you're reflecting to yourself, that's who I was when I did that thing. That's who I was when I spoke or acted unskillfully. When you look at really, really bad things that may have been done to you, you know, whether in the family context or some other in the past, and you can look back and you have that understanding of yourself, and somebody did something that's really harmful or damaging to you, say, look who that person was at the time they did that. You know, look at the hell realm they must have been occupying that would have caused them to do or say what they did in the time that caused me the harm that they did. So it doesn't mean not we're taking responsibility for your karma. It means having an understanding of all of those things that happened, all the stuff that came together to make you who you were at the time that that occurred. It makes it possible to look back on who you were at that point in time with compassion and with a sense of forgiveness. And at the same time, when you have that insight, it also kind of morally charges us in the moment. Because, now I have that understanding. Now I see the cause-effect relationship between what I said or did back then and the harm that it caused. And now I can see that to be the case. Now I can resolve not to do the same thing in the future in a way that will cause that kind of harm in the future. Obviously, easier said than done. You know, Ajahn Chah, the Thai Forest Meditation Master, said, one of the things that can make Dharma practice kind of excruciating sometimes is you can look back and you can see these really crummy things that you did in the past And then you see the urge arise to do them again, and you resolve not to, but sometimes you do anyway. Those of us who sometimes struggle with addictive behaviors know exactly what I'm talking about, right? You can know clearly, you know, there's certain self-destructive things that really cause yourself harm, maybe others as well, and you resolve not to do them, but the craving is really strong. And so sometimes all, you know, so the difficulties in Dharma practice sometimes can be you get the insight into the past behavior and the harm that it's caused, and then you see the same impulses arise in the moment. And this is where, you know, going back to the meditative factors, right effort comes in. And right effort means there's actually, it's kind of a four-cell matrix. It means that if the unwholesome has arisen, then you don't give it nutriment. You don't feed it. You don't give it energy. And if the unwholesome is about to arise but hasn't yet, then you do not allow it to. You watch it begin to, and then you note it for what it is. The Buddha would say, oh, I see you, Mara. You know, the unwholesome beginning to arise, and having recognized that it doesn't. The other two are seeing the wholesome arising, a thought of or an intention having to do with generosity or kindness, wanting to help another, and you act on it. Or that the wholesome has already arisen, states of equanimity or selfless joy or compassion or whatnot. And so you continue to act on those and feed those, right? So it's this relationship between insight into what's going on in your mind at any given point in time and the effort you put forth. So the two wisdom factors, right or skillful, wholesome view, understanding, okay, ability to see into your own past. And then the other of the wisdom factors is right intention. Sankappa is the Pali word for it. So you can think of it as the two wisdom factors, one of them being insight into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who you were up until the present moment. And then the other one, in right intention, okay, is insight into the causes and conditions giving rise to who you may be in the next moment, whether or not you're going to act on the wholesome, okay, or act on the unwholesome, you know. So it's the, and this is the crossroads, as the Buddha taught it. This is where the freedom lies. It's the relationship between intention and action. So, when my current understanding, the way that I have come to have a better feel for karma, for action, is to not only think about the action itself, but I think about that set of three. Okay. The first is sankappa, intention. The second is karma, the action. And the third, the Pali word for it is vipaka, and sometimes translated as fruition, sometimes translated as consequences. So, for instance, you know, the simile the Buddha used a lot, you know, like if there's a tree that is, you know, being pollinated, blossoms are being pollinated. The moment of pollination and the creation of the new seed with its genetic material, its genetic code, okay. That's the action. Okay. And whatever the nutriments were that went into that action, that seminal action, okay, will determine its fruition, will determine what kind of fruit is born. Okay. So intention, sankalpa, informs action. Action leads to consequences. And for me, that brings it into a little more clear focus the nature of the teaching on karma, because oftentimes, and we use karma as kind of a shorthand for all three of those. What's the intention that gave rise to the action? What's the action itself? And what are the consequences of the fruition of the outcome of the action? Okay. And a lot of what insight meditation is about is, when we're going back to the wisdom factors, you know, the first of the wisdom factors, when we're looking at our own past karma, right? That's what we're really looking at. Uh-huh. That was the intention underlying that action. That's the action I took, and those were the consequences. Okay. And it works both ways. That's for unwholesome, and it's for wholesome as well. Okay. That's how we learn to gradually bring about the cessation of suffering, is looking at the relationship between those three in our own history. Questions? Comments? The time for them. These are, you know, kind of slippery concepts, but they're really worth dwelling on and chewing on a little bit. So you can raise your hand, you can use the board, you can write, you can send me a note if you don't want to speak out, but now it's a good time to, you know, chew on this stuff, kick it around a little bit. Anyone have any questions or anything you want to say? Please, Gloria.
Got it. Thank you, Charlotte. So what, I keep making comparisons to my background in 12-step programs.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, when I get to that place where the circumstances are reminiscent of the causes and conditions that not compel me, but tend me toward a particular unskillful
yes.
action. In a 12-step program, I would be advised to turn it over.
What do you say? What do you mean by turn it over?
Turn it over to a higher power.
Right.
But here, it sounds like I'm being encouraged to clarify my intention and make sure it's a skillful one. But what if there are two people with the same causes and conditions, have the same stimulus to do something unskillful? One person does it and the other person doesn't. Is it that one person was able to summon up the right intention and the other wasn't?
It's a really good question. Many years ago, there was a 12-step meeting that took place in the Denver Zen Center. There are people from various Dharma traditions around the Denver area who attended that meeting. And I was there giving some teachings one evening, and I was giving a teaching about not-self, about emptiness. And because that's one of the things that, and Kevin Griffin, you know, my friend who's written, a fellow teacher who's written some books on the topic, you know, One Breath at a Time, on Buddhism and the 12 Steps. So I was giving this teaching about not-self, and one of the people in the group said, you know, well, that's all very well and good, but at 3 a.m, when every cell in my body is crying out for a drink, emptiness doesn't quite get it.
Yeah, it's true.
You need a little something more, a little something else to sort of hang your head on, right? And he goes, absolutely right. You know, there are different teachings and different practices that are most appropriate or useful for different situations, right? And so in that moment of craving, that moment of powerful craving, the mind clearly knows this is dukkha, you know, this is craving, this is the first and second noble truths, right? What resources are at my disposal? What resources are within me? What resources does Buddha Dharma have to offer in this my hour of need? And so, at least in the Theravada tradition, there are two that are really important. One is the practice of metta, of loving kindness practice, especially karuna, the practice of self-compassion. And whatever words and phrases that you use, you know, like the ones that I use, you know, may I be free of all, you know, physical affliction and, you know, physical suffering and mental affliction, right? And then, of course, I'm not at that point in time. And then it's, may I acknowledge and accept any mental affliction or physical difficulties I encounter in myself with courage and with caring and with kindness. So in lieu of sort of the higher self in the theistic traditions, what you're doing is essentially summoning forth your own Buddha nature, you know. And this is the practice of, you know, metta and Theravada Buddhism. In the Tibetan tradition, it can be doing the chants to Tara, the Bodhisattva of Compassionate Action. But essentially what you're doing is summoning forth your own Buddha nature, the inherent wisdom and compassion that lies within each one of us. And so just doing that practice can sometimes be helpful. If there's something that you do in the alternative, sometimes it can be singing a song, it can be reading something, just anywhere else to put your mind. And then thirdly, of course, is Sangha, you know, and that's where the real power of recovery groups comes into play, you know, that, you know, if you're in a sponsoring relationship or just, you know, there's another member of a support group that you're really close to, just to be able to call them up and say, hey, you know, I'm really jammed up here. There are things I know to be true that I can't remember right now. Can you help me remember them? So those are some thoughts that come to mind. I think dwelling on emptiness, the guy was right, doesn't really get it. But that there are, and the reason that we do things like practicing metta for ourselves, especially self-compassion for ourselves, as often as we, you know, find the circumstances allowing us to do it, is so that training is there when we need it. So it's already part of our consciousness. We know that's what's happening. It's what Thomas Merton called the dark night of the soul. You know, those 3 a.m. times when, or whenever it arises, and it seems like it's kind of gotcha. Having these trainings in mind can be super helpful. At least that's my experience. Is that helpful to you? Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you. So please, that's a rich question. Other reflections or comments, questions? Carolyn, are you?
My thought, pondering question is, so if we are the product of our previous experiences, teachings, things that we may not have had much control over that just came right. our way. And that influences our intention and action. Where does free will come in?
Good question. And it's one of the classic ones in Buddha Dharma. As set alongside Western philosophy and Western perspectives on this. And again, it goes back to the Buddha's teachings on not self. In order for there to be free will, or for there not to be free will, there has to be a self who either has or does not have free will. Tricky, I mean, this is where not-self gets, you know, kind of out there. But it can really ultimately be reduced to something as simple as when a little kid puts your hand on a hot stove for the first time. And experientially learns in an instant that that's not a good thing to do because it really hurts. And so one's own Buddha nature can be thought of as being kind of like that response. The encountering of dukkha and the automatic disinclination to perpetuate the dukkha. So in that understanding, it's kind of the universe taking care of itself insofar as the cessation of suffering is concerned. Where it gets complicated is where the evidence of dukkha is kind of masked in some way. So again, going back to the example of addictive cravings of one kind or another. People don't get drawn into addictive situations because they want to suffer. They tend to get drawn into addictive situations because they're trying to find freedom from suffering. You know, and that's what drew them to do something that may have given them temporary relief for a while. And so they did it again and again and again until eventually it becomes apparent that that which had been relied upon for a source of release from suffering in fact becomes a source of suffering itself, like drinking seawater to quench your thirst. So that's where the teachings about being very mindful of one's behaviors, you know, what the effects of them become so important. Because when you become able to see the dukkha behind the effort to end suffering in an unskillful way, then the unskillful efforts begin to diminish in power. And they begin to fall away simply because you have the insight or the understanding that that's not really where freedom lies. You know, the Dalai Lama said once, we pursue pleasure as a substitute for happiness. You know, and again, this is subtle, tricky stuff, you know, and it really takes the practice of mindfulness to be able to see the dukkha behind the veil of apparent pleasure. Yeah, but ultimately it's the universe working toward the cessation of suffering by means of our consciousness. Yeah. Hope that's helpful. Okay. There are questions or comments? Well, what I want to do then is touch a little bit on the phrases that I use to close our sitting. And that was what the Buddha called five daily recollections. And the first is, I am of a nature to age. I have not gotten beyond aging. The second, I am subject to illness and infirmity. I have not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. Third, I am of a nature to die. I have not gotten beyond death. Fourth, all that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. Big hit during COVID-19, right? And fifth is, I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I had sprung. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I shall become the heir. So it's just that flow. You know, one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. So that little poem is talking about this very process, you know. I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. So I am who I am in this present moment because of the flow of causes and conditions in my own past. Right? My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. That's why I am who I am in this moment in time. My actions are my relations. What that's about is we don't act in the world in a vacuum. Whenever we say or do anything, it has an effect, either beneficial or unwholesome. Right? We relate to each other by means of this karmic web. My actions are my protection. By that is meant that if you really work this, you know, if you really do what you can to speak and act with integrity and with wholesome intention, it protects you from harm, self-caused harm in the future. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I shall become the heir. This is related in turn to another kind of interesting teaching. It's one of those sort of more obscure ones you don't hear a lot about, but I found it to be really important, being kind of an aversive type. States of mind that the Buddha talks about leading up to the decision to inquire into the Buddha Dharma, into the teachings. And it's two states of mind. First is called Samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A. And that is variously translated as worry or anxiety, sometimes as dread. And there are various sources of Samvega, as the Buddha described them. Okay. One is fear of death, like in the five daily recollections. Another is described as fear of loss of nutriment. And by that, it means fear of starving to death. Because back in the Buddha's day, if somebody at the wrong end of the caste system, things didn't work out well, they might not have enough to eat. They might starve. And there were famines, and great numbers of people died of starving. So fear of that, fear of not being able to attain the sustenance needed to stay alive. Another source of fear or anxiety in those teachings is fear of the future consequences of past actions. You know, there's that whole what goes around comes around, or, you know, vice versa. In other words, being worried about what might be the future consequences of some unskillful action that you took sometime in the past, cheating somebody, or relationship that didn't go down right, or something, you know, fearing future harm based on past action. And then there's also another one, which is interesting, which is fear of the future consequences of future actions. So in other words, if I blow it sometime in the future, you know, fear of the consequences that will ensue from my not having, you know, acted skillfully or in a wholesome way. Samvega. And so, unhappy states of mind, as you can hear. The Buddha said this is kind of an important phase, though, because it's what brings a lot of people to the Dharma. You know, they have those worries, those fears. But once they begin to practice the Dharma, and once they get some understanding of it, and then they are able to ascertain the teachings of not-self, then pasada, the other half of that, is sometimes translated as confidence or assurance, right? So the samvega, the anxiety and the worry, is also emanating from or predicated on the existence of self. I did nasty stuff in the past and I'm going to pay for it, you know, or I'm such a rotten bastard, no doubt I'm going to do some rotten things in the future and I'm going to really pay for that, right? But it's based upon a mistrust of self. However, the Buddha says, you know, you establish the meditative factors, you know, of effort and concentration, mindfulness, begin to have these insights into not-self. Then you begin to develop a different understanding about the nature of your karma. It's the difference between the understanding of karma in Hinduism and the understanding of karma in Buddhism, which is to say the confidence comes from saying, oh, wow, look who I was when I did that stuff. That's not the person I am now, even though I might have some of the same tendencies, right? But now I have the knowledge of how to bring right effort to bear on those tendencies. So it becomes much less likely that I'm going to speak or act in an unwholesome way in the future. So that's where the confidence starts to come from. You begin to have more faith in yourself. You begin to have more faith in your own Buddha nature. Okay. You begin to have more faith in the Dharma. That if I do these things, if I practice these teachings, if I do these practices, right, then it will incline me toward taking better care of myself in the future, of taking better care of others in the future, of taking better care of society in the future. And so even though difficult when the samvega is being experienced, the anxiety and the worry and the fear, then when you're able to shift into that other perspective, it can be quite confidence building. And I find myself sometimes feeling really anxious and afraid for the future of our society, our culture, of our body politic, right? And I find that the same thing applies. You know? How does one shift from one to the other? You know, and as much as we're not a Buddhist nation, can't really use the terms of the Dharma to talk about this stuff. But later on in our series, I'll be going into more detail about, okay, what if as a society we're experiencing extraordinary samvega right now? What are means by which we can restore some feeling of confidence in our ability as a culture, as a society, as a community, okay, to incline toward the wholesome, to incline toward the good. So it's something we try to do individually, something we try to do as a Sangha in our own communities, and for everybody's sake, for the sake of our shared karma, it's something that probably needs to be really worked on going forward as well. So there's that. Other questions or comments? Is that it for everybody? Steve? You have a question or are you just adjusting your camera? Okay. Well, dear friends, that's all I've got for tonight. If no one else has any questions, there's nothing to say. We have to drag it out all the way to 8. So I'm happy for us to go our separate ways and look forward to getting together again, at least in my case, 2 weeks from now, and kind of pick up where we left off. Okay. All right. Done. So, that being the case, why don't we settle back into our sitting posture for just a minute? Allow the eyes to gently close. Attention to come to rest on the breathing. Bhava tu sava mangalam rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava buddha nubhavena sada soti bhavantu te. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhava tu sava mangalam rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava dhamma nubhavena sava soti bhavantute. By the power of all the dharma, may you always be well. Bhava tu sava mangalam rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha nubhavena sada soti bhavantu te. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha mangalam rakantu sava devata. Sava sangha nubhavena sada soti bhavantu te. By the power of all the sangha, may you always be well. Bhava tu sava mangalam rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Have a good week, everybody.
Thanks,
Lloyd. Stay safe and be well.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thanks, Sarah Lloyd.
Thank you.
A good Thanksgiving to all.
Yeah, you. For sure.